And good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also very happy to have back on the show once again Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She is here on the program once a month. It is always on a Tuesday. And we talk about things that grow in the home landscape. So it's an opportunity to talk about problems. So if there's something going wrong and not quite sure how to deal with it, there may in fact be some problems still from the last growing season you really weren't quite sure how to deal with. Oh, we can do that. But at this time of year now, this is the time when a lot of folks are thinking about what they want to plant in the growing season to come. So they're spending their time looking at books about gardening and landscaping and looking through catalogs. And there are a lot of folks, growing number of people, I think, who are really interested in bringing more native plants to their home landscape. But it can sometimes be kind of difficult to figure out, well, you know, what plants can I be looking at? And particularly if there's something, a particular kind of plant you like, and it's not native, and you'd say, well, is there a native alternative that's kind of like that? Well, yes, in fact, there certainly are. And that's really the focus of a book that we'll also be talking about this morning. It's called The Midwestern Native Garden, An Illustrated Guide. And it is a very nice book, which has been co-authored by Charlotte Edelman. She is joining us this morning by telephone. And Ms. Edelman, hello.
Hello.
And she's been good enough to spend some time with us to talk a little bit about what things that we can do to incorporate more native plants in the landscape. So we'd be happy to take questions about that and also the kinds of things that Sandy does every month when she is here. And we have already somebody who's ready to go. So if you got some plant questions, that's great. We talk about indoor plants, that's great. And particularly if you want to talk a little bit about native plants and how to get more of them into your landscape, we can do that too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe I'll just ask you, Ms. Edelman, talk a little bit about, was there some particular thing that really got you interested in for your own yard to try to get more native plants into the landscape?
Well, yes, I had observations over time. I've loved gardening for many years. I used to be a gardener with lots of daylilies and daffodils and tulips, and I noticed that the plants that really brought in the butterflies were not these non-native plants from Asia and Europe, but were the native plants like goldenrods and coneflowers, and that made me kind of move into looking into that, because that's something I felt was really a part of gardening. It's not just to have flowers standing there, but also to have beautiful butterflies and other insects and birds visiting the flowers. So that was my experience as I wandered through my neighborhood looking at parks and people's backyards and things like that.
Yeah, I think I like that idea, because it encourages you to think of your home landscape and your plantings as part of a bigger system.
Exactly.
You know? And it's not just something for you to sit there and look at. The idea that it's part of a bigger system and does involve all these other things, and isn't it great to be able to see butterflies and to see birds and to be able to enjoy them as they go around doing their thing as well?
Well, it is, and I just would add that after I created my personal native gardens, I immediately started getting monarch butterflies visiting the milkweeds, that's the only plant they can lay their eggs on. And I was amazed to be able to watch tiny caterpillars grow into big fat caterpillars and then wander off to be chrysalises. I mean, I couldn't believe it. In my own yard, I was actually growing butterflies. So it's a thrill. I think it's an unmatched thrill.
And I think the other thing, too, this is Sandy Mason, and hi, Charlotte. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay.
I think the other thing, too, and Charlotte, maybe you can attest to this, too, is the fact that I think, especially the book by Doug Tallamy, that Bringing Nature Home, and I think it's the whole idea of, it's not just that we think this is, you know, obviously this is great, we got these native plants and all the butterflies and stuff, but you know, it may actually be even farther than that, in the sense that for some of these insects, animals and stuff, maybe this is the only place they can survive now. now because of their native areas, their wild areas, their natural areas are being, you know, modernized, urbanized. It's to the point that they don't have places to go and places to breed and live and carry out their whole life cycle. So I think home gardens have become even more important in the sense that this may be that one thing that keeps some species from actually going over the brink just by the fact that we have these native plants and they're able to complete their whole life cycle. So I think it ends up being actually an important thing as well as just a really a fun thing. So
oh, I absolutely agree with you. And of course, I think a lot of people, before they will get into the issue of how important it is, first they want to see if it really works. And then I think it's something that people just, once you get into it, it just moves along. I mean, there are a lot, and as you just said, a lot. It's shocking how many native plants, according to the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, over 200 species of North American plants have already gone extinct because of exactly what you were talking about, building, farming, putting areas into, you know, taking out the native areas and replacing them with other kinds of things. And the book, my book, our book, The Midwestern Native Garden, one of the things we do is we list non-native plants and tell whether, according to USDA Plants, which is a website that everybody who is interested in plants should be aware of, you can look at that website and find out if a plant is native to North America or introduced to North America. And if it's native, you can find out whether it is endangered or has other problems. And to my surprise, when I researched this book, it is amazing how many of the native plants are endangered and actually extirpated, I believe is how you pronounce it, are extinct in certain places, like the purple coneflower is extinct in parts of the Midwest. So obviously, by planting purple coneflowers, we're not only having beautiful native flowers, we're helping keep a species of native flower from going extinct.
Right, and all the insects and stuff that depend on it, too. I think the one thing that's really nice about your book is the fact that I think, you know, for a lot of us, and just what you were alluding to, is the fact that, you know, we still want beautiful gardens. I mean,
Right. We're
gardeners. We want beautiful gardens. Yeah. But you don't have to give up on beautiful gardens. And it's just a matter of really getting to know some of these native species that really do a fine job of being beautiful, but then give us that added benefit of being native. So I think that's the thing that's great about your book. I like that part.
Thank you.
Well, I tell you what, we have some callers, and we'll see what sorts of things are on their minds, whether they're the kind of things that we do all the time, whether they'd like to talk about native use of native plants. Any and all of that is certainly great. Our guest this morning, Sandy Mason, she's horticulture educator with U of I Extension, and joining us by telephone, Charlotte Edelman. She is the co-author of the book, The Midwestern Native Garden, an Illustrated Guide, Ohio University Press is the publisher. Well, we got several people. In fact, the lines are full, so let's go to it, and we'll start with someone in Robinson, and this is line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is a question for Sandra. Years ago, I used to use grow lights in starting seeds and keeping plants alive in midwinter in the house. Recently, no, let me back up. There used to be a lot of commentary in the literature about what color light was best for that purpose, whether mm-hmm. it should be pink or yellow or green or whatever. Recently, I bought two of those new super-duper corkscrew fluorescent bulbs and installed them in floor lamps pointed at my indoor plants.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen anything in the literature, or have any of your listeners heard anything about how effective those are going to be?
Well, actually, those should be better. Not only are they more efficient, they actually give a wider spectrum of light. And because the trouble with those incandescent bulbs is that they give off a lot of energy as heat. We don't really see, not really the light that plants and that we can use it, really, they give off a lot of heat, which we really don't need. Whereas the complex fluorescents and stuff now are at the point where they're much more efficient. So you actually are getting more light, more lumens per whatever light that you have. So
right.
it should be better.
they're so much cheaper to run.
Absolutely. So you're on the right track. So it's better for you, and it should be better for your plants. I think you should notice that actually you get better growth from
great.
Them.
Thank so, you
great.
Very much,
good,
Sandra.
Good point, though.
Okay, thank you. And should it, I mean, would it make sense for you to, if you were going to use a light like that, to look for something that said daylight or something that was supposed to be like the same light
right.
that you got,
right.
get from the sun?
Right, right. Or if it says somehow full spectrum or something like that, or daylight or something like that. Because you're right. That more than likely, that's going to be light that's going to be better for the plants in the long run. And, of course, the farther away the lights are from the plants, the less light there is for the plants. So you really want them to be fairly close, which is the other nice thing about the complex fluorescence. They're not giving off a lot of heat to the point where you can't get them fairly close. So, in other words, closer is better when it comes to these complex fluorescence. So.
All right.
And
well, we'll go on again to over to Belgium. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. And a comment about the gentleman's last question. Look into LED grow lights now. They're much more expensive, but they have a 100,000-hour use limit. So they're expensive at the first. They're much cheaper to run, and they are very, very good. They can blend your colors just right. Number two, to go along with the special guest you have here, I've been always advocating for stopping to mow the roadsides to allow a lot of these native plants to come back, because they will come back along the roadsides. We not only save gas from mowing it, but we also provide a place for a lot of these plants that don't exist.
Right.
And the question I have for you. I have been given a plant here recently, and I don't know what it is. I think it's a succulent. It's green. It's kind of ropey. Has little leaves on it that come right off the stem that are kind of teardrop-shaped. They're kind of a lime green, and if you touch them, they fall apart real easy. Do you know what that plant is?
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure what it is.
Oh, okay.
I would look, you might look at a couple of pictures. I'd have to look at some pictures to see. There's a thing called donkey's tail.
That might be it.
Yeah, it's called donkey's tail, and I think it's like a Crassula, I think might be the genus. I'm not quite sure on that. But you might look at some pictures of that. That would be my first place to go.
This one grows right along the ground. It doesn't grow up at all. It just hugs right along and tips over the side of the pot.
Right.
Tall.
But the fact that the leaves just fall off, that made me think of donkey's tail.
Yeah, this is real, real easy. Very, very fragile plant.
Yeah, yeah, that would be. But all those little leaves will start new ones, so you can have lots and lots and lots of plants to give to your friends or enemies or whatever.
Thank you very much.
All right,
sure.
Thanks for the call. I don't know, Ms. Edelman, do you have any thoughts on this issue of mowing roadsides?
Well, I do. I spent a lot of time collecting signatures on petitions to my local IDOT, and finally was given a tour. My husband and I were given a tour by the IDOT people of the roadsides along our local area. And they had been definitely, as they said, the IDOT authorities said, over-mowed. They were mowed and mowed. And, of course, the United States government had paid for putting a lot of native plant seeds down. So I thought they should be permitted to grow. And it took a while, but I think our local IDOT is letting the roadsides grow a lot more than they did before. But one of the unfortunate side effects, and I guess no good deed goes unpunished, is that teasel has moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just destroying these roadsides. And they're just, so far, unable to keep up with trying to poison them, essentially, this teasel, so that what's unfortunately happened is, although the native grasses and flowers look wonderful, now they're becoming totally interspersed with this horribly invasive teasel, which was introduced into the United States in the 1700s to help people card wool. And it's a major problem. I think the sides of the roads are one of the last bastions of plants to some extent, and I hope that somehow they will have the money to pay people to get rid of this teasel and keep it out of the roadsides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I guess that also points at one of the reasons to try to cultivate native plants. And also not to be bringing in something from someplace else,
right,
just because you kind of like the way it looks, because you can get that kind of problem with things becoming very invasive and running away with themselves and out-competing the local plants, and then that can be a huge problem. And I don't know.
If I may,
yeah, uh-huh.
On that point, one of the most really dramatic demonstrations of this, I think, is Dame's Rocket. You know, Dame's Rocket is this extremely decorative pink-flowered plant that a lot of my friends think is a native phlox. I mean, it takes a long time to learn these things. We're not born knowing all of this stuff. But Dame's Rocket was introduced during the colonial period into the United States. It became very popular, and now it is considered an invasive plant, and I think it's 46 states, according to USDA plants. So there's just, to me, the actual best example of a very pretty plant that looks so appealing. You plant it, and now it's a non-native invasive plant that is covering all our natural areas and is a major problem.
And again, the advantage, though, of the book like yours is you could say to somebody, okay, you like that plant? I can give you one that looks pretty much like that, so you can have that. You can have this attractive plant, and it's not going to have, it's not going to bring that kind of baggage with it.
Absolutely, and for Dame's Rocket, for example, because it's called, it has the common name of wild phlox. Obviously, native alternatives are the native phloxes, which are just beautiful, and also are host plants. And host plants, in case people aren't familiar with that term, is a plant upon which a butterfly or a moth lays her eggs. It's like the monarch butterfly. Its only host plant are milkweed species. Well, for hummingbird hawk moths, for example, they lay their eggs on these native phlox plants. And so all these native plants have several functions. I mean, they cannot become invasive non-natives because they are natives. Then they also provide pollen and nectar to innumerable species of bees and butterflies. And on top of it, they are the places where our beautiful butterflies need to lay their eggs. So, I feel it's an unbeatable combination.
All right. We have certainly time for other calls, questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here in the studio with me, Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension. And on the phone, Charlotte Edelman. She's the co-author of the book, The Midwestern Native Garden, An Illustrated Guide, which does just this thing that we've talked about. It shows the kinds of plants that sometimes people like, but maybe are problematic, and then suggests native alternatives, things that look like that, but work better in our landscape and will help you create more of a native ecosystem right there in your backyard. And it's published by the Ohio University Press. So whatever questions folks have, we'd be very happy to have them. Next, we'll talk with somebody in Paris, Illinois, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sandy, got a question about houseplants.
Okay.
How do you clean the leaves on an African violet?
Boy, really good question.
And they look like crud.
Yeah. Well, I know we have a few people that often listen to the show that are actually experts on African violet, so they may have other thoughts. I think what I have actually done is just to use a very fine paintbrush, like an artist paintbrush, and just sort of, worked them off that way. Because unless a lot of people don't realize the fact that maybe you really don't want to put water necessarily on the leaves.
I knew that part.
Not everybody knows that, but so it's really not a good idea. So I would think just an artist paintbrush or something like that usually is enough that you can go ahead and clean them off. But there may be some other folks that have some other ideas. But yeah.
Oh, you're a doll. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right, thank you.
Take care.
Let's
Bye-bye.
Go on to Champaign. This is another caller, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question for Sandy. I have a house plant. I think it's a Scheffalera. It's about 23 years old.
Oh, wow.
This year, when I brought it in, it just started losing leaves, and it hadn't done that before, just dropping leaves, and it also is putting new leaves out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So did the leaves turn yellow first before they fell, or they just fell green?
Oh, no, they turned yellow and sort of brown even, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and you're sure they didn't get too cold? Did you got it in time? wouldn't have gotten too cold.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, because sometimes a little bit of, because most of those guys really won't tolerate temperatures below 45 or so. So even a little bit of a nip sometimes can. So, but if it's putting on new growth, that's good. We know that. If it's that old, has it been replanted or repotted at any time? Or
no.
Yeah. The problem is, I know a few problems when they get to be particularly big, which I imagine this one is. It gets harder and harder to replant them. But but when they've been in the same pot for a long period of time, then often that soil really needs to be replenished. A lot of times there's some dead roots and stuff in there, and it's just, it gets harder and harder to water them properly.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes they end up getting overwatered, underwatered often. So I have a feeling it probably needs to be repotted. You may need a whole army to help you do
that
this. I don't know how
suspicion.
Big it is. Yeah, you may need a little bit of help to do that. But I would really think that's probably what's going on. And if you can sort of plan for that, and it doesn't have to be a lot bigger pot, but certainly one that's a little bit bigger. And then you can cut off any roots that look brown and obviously dead, pull them apart, get new soil, and I think you'll probably find that's better. And because sometimes the houseplants will actually lose their leaves, especially if they're going from outdoors to indoors because the light levels are so much lower.
Well, it didn't seem to do that. But
in
one
the past.
Thing that was different this year was it rained so much that it put on lots more leaves than it had.
Yeah, so it was probably very lush and really doing well. And then we bring it indoors where everything's a lot different, where lower light levels and stuff. So, yeah, so that's probably what's going on. It was just doing so well outside that... And just what I usually say is that have them hang on until spring. with some of my houseplants, I just say, hang on until spring. I'll get you back outside. So,
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll go on again here. Another person in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Is it me?
Yes, sir.
A commentary on the teasel. By far, if you have a decent prairie, by far the best way of treating it is to spot herbicide. You get a fairly strong herbicide. It has a really big rosette, which takes out your prairie plants. You put a dye in the herbicide to allow you to figure out where you've been, mm-hmm. but you spot herbicide it, and you make sure that it doesn't produce its balls. And it's especially bad in these cemeteries where it's used as a dried arrangement. The Department of Transportation at the federal level is trying to encourage people to do things along the roadside, but the funding situation has taken some of those people out of action. The Departments of Transportation have been pretty generous about trying to do things with NOMO, but there's a problem that the people who do the mowing and the herbiciding do not know the value of a remnant prairie, for instance, along the roadside, railroad side. So we lose those things to blanket herbiciding and come along with a high rise, like corn harvester type herbicider, and you blanket spray with a scungy herbicide, and that's very, very deleterious. We just had a genuine accident in that situation on private territory that we bought at Rantoul, which takes out that remnant prairie that was nearby and some of that stuff permanently. We also have another situation at Pisodum where a long-time remnant prairie is being replaced by a sewage treatment plant. And that sort of thing is disappointing, but it's understandable that we have to know that DOT is doing no more policies where they can, and they need to be in contact with the drivers of the tractors because they do not know about a prairie. And so general education about a prairie is very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's a really good point, is that it's not, I think the one thing about mowing is the fact that you don't need to know the plants. I mean, so a lot of times that was just sort of the way to deal with things, that we just mowed it, and because people didn't have to know individual plants. They just mowed everything. Well, now we have to be better educated, have to know which plants are truly native. Are these remnant prairies? Are there certain plants we should be looking? I was amazed when I first moved out into the country that as I was just sort of out walking the dog, that even even those these roadsides that had been mowed, I'm sure, over and over and over again for a very long time, I noticed there was like big blue stem coming up. These were native grasses coming up in the, these roadsides that had been mowed forever, but yet those plants were still there. And so it's really kind of amazing the fact that some of these plants will hang on for long periods of time, but it takes, to everybody else, they probably just looked at that and it was just a bunch of grass. So it's educating more people.
Well, and of course that's the big part. That's more labor intensive if you're going to have to go through and say, this plant is good, this plant is bad.
I know. And it is. It takes knowledge and it takes labor when you have those kinds of things. And I think that's why, you know, we have a Master Naturalist program here in Illinois and probably certainly other parts of the Midwest and actually throughout the United States have Master Naturalist programs. And that's one of the things that they're doing is to actually work on these non-native, very aggressive plants and tease all everything else, trying to sort of deal with those. Because it does take a lot of labor to do it and money too when it comes to things like herbicides and stuff. So it's a big issue, and I think that's probably why, or it is why gardeners need to just be better armed with that information on what plants to use and what plants not to use.
And Ms. Edelman, again, anything you might want to add on?
Well, the mowing issue is really the best thing to do, and some of our neighboring states do this kind of thing, is to just have, as they say, one swipe of the lawnmower, which is about maybe 5 feet or so wide, to go along the road to keep it mowed so that it won't interfere with traffic and that kind of thing. And then whatever is beyond that one swipe of the lawnmower just grows, and that's it. Now, that has nothing to do with mowing anymore. You just don't mow it. The issue of what to do with the invasive non-native plants then has to be is something that you have to evaluate and decide if you're going to have some kind of a program to get rid of specific plants like teasel, which, of course, the gentleman is absolutely right, requires a very specific remedy. And, of course, at the moment, like so many governmental issues, they don't have the money to do this. And one of the things that's going on where I live is there is an effort of several different kinds of organizations to try to raise consciousness and actually attack the problem. And a very fine young lady is working at the, her headquarters are at the Chicago Botanic Garden, and she's part of Chicago Wilderness. And so they're tackling this problem, but it's a big problem, obviously. But it's not just mowing. You don't just get rid of things by mowing them. You get rid of them by specifically removing the individual, now it's ecosystems or whatever, bad ecosystems, because where I live, it just covers miles and miles of the roadsides. And it's a very difficult challenge.
But I will say, too, though, that sometimes mowing is used as a tactic to get rid of things. Because you're trying to get rid of it. Because the other problem that we have, too, is the fact that if you don't mow an area, what you find out very, very quickly is that every single mulberry that gets dropped, seed gets dropped, starts to sprout, honeysuckle starts to come up. So we start to end up with all these other non-natives, and they end up being woody species that will also be certainly a problem for prairie species, because once we start getting
absolutely.
That much shade. So sometimes things have to be mowed or need to be mowed periodically just to keep down the woody species.
Mowing is a tool, obviously.
Right.
And a lot of course, in prairies, people would prefer to have burning as a kind of a tool. But using mowing as a tool to keep the woody species down is something that doesn't have to be done every single week.
Right, absolutely.
Once a year. And the people on the lawnmowers, they should be able to be advised by their superiors that they are not supposed to do certain things. And they are not the kings of the lawnmowers. They are merely employees, and it's their obligation, the supervisors, to tell them you can only mow one swipe along the highway or whatever it is that is the IDOT policy, which happens to be something like one swipe along the highway. So it's also a question of implementing the guidelines and rules that are already in place but are being ignored because people stop paying attention after a while. And so I think it's up to people in the community to write letters to IDOT and to other governmental agencies or whatever that have unenvironmentally positive policies and call their attention to that fact and remind them that there are people who do care about this.
We are talking this morning here about things that grow in the home landscape and particularly talking about Midwestern native plants and how they can be incorporated into the home landscape with our two guests, Sandy Mason and Charlotte Edelman. And we will talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
When struggling to write about growing up Muslim in Milwaukee, author Ayad Akhtar turned to Jewish writers like Saul Bellow and Philip Roth.
That's the sensibility that I really drew from as an aspiring writer. It was a minority community that was identified by their religious identity. And it was the same thing for us, for Muslims.
Akhtar's novel is American Dervish. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign Park District, presenting The Capitol Steps at the Virginia Theater on Saturday, February 18th at 8 p.m. For over 30 years, The Capitol Steps have lampooned Washington and the world inside the Beltway. Ticket information is available at thevirginia.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics tomorrow morning. We'll be talking with a writer who teaches writing here at the University of Illinois. Alex Shekar is his name, and we'll talk about his new novel, Luminarium, which is a very interesting exploration of what religious experience is all about and where it comes from, and can it be induced by artificial means. That's tomorrow at 10. Then we'll talk about current events in Pakistan with Stephen Cohen. He's now a senior fellow in foreign policy at the 21st Century Defense Initiative, was for a long time professor of political science here at the U of I. And then Thursday at 10, the topic is the National Labor Relations Board and the role of collective bargaining in civil society. There we'll have two guests, Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld, who is the dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the U of I. And also joining us will be Wilma Liebman. She served between January of 2009 and August of 2011 as the chair of the National Labor Relations Board. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to the website. It's will.illinois.edu. This morning, we have two guests with us. Sandy Mason's here. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She's on the program once a month. We talk about things that grow in the home landscape. And as a special guest this morning, we also have Charlotte Edelman. She's the co-author of The Midwestern Native Garden and Illustrated Guides, published by the University of Ohio Press. It's a great resource book for people who would like to have more native plants in their landscape and are looking for good suggestions. And it's particularly nice because it takes a non-native plant, and you might say, oh, I like that plant. But then you'd say, well, okay, can I have something kind of like that that's native? That's the idea of the book. And she says, yeah, here you go. Here's something that's native that's like what it is you're looking at. And so questions welcome on anything having to do with gardening, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's somebody here in Champaign County where we are. Line two. Hello.
Hi. Let me take you off the speaker. The question I have to do with things that may not be native, but anyway. The first thing is, though, I have had a four-year plan to get rid of all of the honeysuckle shrub.
Mm-hmm.
Out of my yard, and I've done it, but I really have liked the plant, but I've seen it, you know, in the woods, and it's just terrible. But is there any thought of these plants being made sterile or something, or some way to enjoy them and their hardiness, but not have them propagate? So that's one question. The other one has to do with black elderberry, which I've had some success in growing, but lately not. And I don't know, I seem to remember that was like a verboten species for a while, too, in my youth. But so it can be a lovely plant, but it seems to not like the heat, or maybe I just didn't get water enough on them. It's a plant that has medicinal use, and I'm looking to grow it for myself. And the other thing is related to that is Arandia, or chokeberry. That is not native to this area. I think it's more eastern forest plant. Both of these may need some kind of these sort of understory plants. Is that true? Or I'll listen.
Okay. I don't know. Sandy, can you...
There's a bunch of questions in there, aren't there? As far as honeysuckles, I don't know, if anybody's looking to try and get them to not be sterile. I think one of the, certainly one of the big problems is they form all these little red berries and the birds love them. And so wherever the birds, do their thing, then you end up with more honeysuckles. So they're quite prolific. And so I don't know of any of them that are sterile. And I think the problem that we've found over the years is that nature finds a way. If you've seen any of the dinosaur movies or any of that stuff, nature finds a way, and things tend to not be sterile after a while. Or, you know, there's a lot of things that we've thought were sterile and then weren't. And so I think there's something that is inherently wrong with thinking that we're always going to find something that's sterile. So I think probably the big thing with honeysuckle is just to find something that's different, which is the whole idea of Charlotte's book, is to find something that's very similar, gives you a lot of those same beautiful characteristics, but actually something quite different. And Charlotte, I don't know if you have one that comes to mind. I have a few ideas, but that would be alternative to honeysuckle.
Oh, well, elderberry.
The other one you mentioned.
I mean, that's a good... talking, though, about the sterility problem, one of the things that I try to point out in the book, which unfortunately, due to space considerations, we weren't really able to get into bushes and trees as much as we would have liked to. It's more flowers and plants like some, you know, vines and ground covers mostly. But one of the big important things about a native plant is that it is the host plant for butterflies. So one can have sterile honeysuckle bushes, and they provide no butterfly with a place to lay her eggs. So to me, that's a consideration. And there are, I always try to remember that all these plants were imported from Asia, and that's where honeysuckle bushes came from, and Europe and places like that, North America was covered with a fabulous suite of native trees, shrubs, flowers, and plants. So it's not like we need a hardy honeysuckle in Illinois. We have plenty of native bushes that have grown here for thousands of years, which are just as hardy as honeysuckle, and also have co-evolved with the native species, and thus they enable butterflies to lay eggs on them, and they provide berries to the birds that are the right size and at the right time, and are part of, as our host was saying, this broader ecosystem. So I would elderberry, chokeberry, those are, I don't know that they aren't native to this part of the Midwest, but or at least chokeberry. But those are the kinds of plants that I would recommend as alternatives to honeysuckle.
And actually, there's a couple more. I would also add to that list, it would be viburnums. There's
absolutely
some actually great native viburnums.
Right.
There's the Arrowwood viburnum, which is just a fabulous, still give you a blue, a bit dark blue. But, and also even the other viburnum that I really like is out of the possum haw, which is a really beautiful one. And, you know, it's a great shrub, beautiful flowers, great fruit on it. I mean, it really gives you all the characteristics. And actually, I would even say more because it's got fall color and everything like that. So it's even better than honeysuckle. So I think you're right. We can get rid of honeysuckle. We don't really need it because there's plenty of other native plants that actually can fill that bill quite well.
If I'm still on, I'm having,
sure,
calling partially because I'm having trouble with the elderberry. Ragged. They're just not doing so well.
You
have
it planted in the wrong place, you know, for the needs of the elderberry, which you could check, you know, obviously by looking on the web and finding out the characteristics that are needed for elderberries to thrive.
I would probably say a couple things in that. Usually they'd like moisture soils. Mm-hmm. So if you have a moisture spot, they'll actually do better if they will get some shade, even though they'll take full sun. But certainly if you have it in full sun, they're going to need moisture. And the one thing that I have seen, it usually doesn't kill off the plant completely, but they do seem to get some canker diseases where you will see some stem die back and that kind of thing. So I would really wonder about the moisture condition. That would probably be one thing that I would wonder about. I don't know where you've got it right now, but that would be one thing. But usually they're pretty tough plants once they get going.
Yeah, well, one of them is gets shade in the afternoon, which I think would be a good thing from the house. But the ones that are, they are also doing, the couple there are doing bad. The ones that get pretty much full sun all day are also not so well. And I guess maybe I just need to water them more.
Yeah.
I thought they might be, in this area, they might be an understory plant, so that maybe they do need to be to get more shade than they're getting now.
They usually do fine with some shade. But usually what I've seen is more of a moisture thing. So okay. they tend to like those more moist areas. And usually, you know, even, you know, just because it's native doesn't mean we never have to water it. I mean, sometimes when plants are first getting established, you need to add a little bit of water. Once they get established, then you can a lot of times just sort of forget the watering. But sometimes when they're brand new like that, they need a little bit of extra help depending on what the weather we're having.
I don't want to go on too long, but one thing I heard from a friend was that some people cut them back every year completely. Is that something you've heard of?
You certainly can
get all new growth. Or?
Yeah, you certainly can do that. That actually helps with the canker issue. It's not something you have to do. I think the thing that people often like with elderberry is the fact that it does have beautiful foliage on it. There actually are some colored varieties now, which we can debate on whether those are actually native or not. Some that have chartreuse leaves and dark leaves as well. And so those actually look better when they're cut back to the ground, which is, I think, maybe is where people are getting that. They tend to get a little rangy, as in they tend to get kind of unkempt sometimes. So I think people often like to cut them back just because they think they look better. But that, again, that's kind of a personal preference.
Of course, elderberries are fabulous for attracting birds because they love to eat the elderberries.
Sure. And the flowers are fragrant. They're actually great plants. They're really...
You know, I just like to stick in here that the subject of honeysuckle bushes brings up an interesting issue, to me anyway, which is the fads that we keep going through. People who have a lot of honeysuckle bushes probably planted them quite a number of years ago because they were a big fad. Then, and you can kind of, I walk around my neighborhood and I can pretty well tell when people landscape because, you know, the honeysuckle bushes were back in, oh, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. Then there's burning bush, which was the obligatory plant for every front yard, which is also invasive now because of that. Then Bradford pear, which is now invasive because every house has to have a Bradford pear in front of it. And, now the big fad, or is a couple of them anyway, is a butterfly bush, which is becoming, which is invasive in parts of the Midwest now, and these Asian grasses, which are now absolutely dominating where I live, which I think is an absolute tragedy because we live in the prairie state, which is composed of tall, native tall grasses, and everyone is planting Asian grasses, essentially, many of which are now becoming and are already invasive. And we have so many beautiful native grasses like big and tall, little and big blue stem and any number of them. So it just kind of is interesting to me to hear somebody mention honeysuckle because it brings to mind the continual fads, which are usually promoting non-native plants.
Because I would add hydrangea to that, too.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think everybody's got hydrangea. And I think the thing is, I don't know if you've ever seen, I've never seen any insect feed on hydrangeas. I think all the flowers must be sterile. They must not have anything in them. That's why they're so big and voluptuous.
Right.
But they have truly no pollen or nectar there. I don't think there's anything there for
insects. And another
insects.
One that I think is just, is to me, amazing to see how many of them are planted are daylilies, which are imported from China, and of course the orange daylily and the yellow daylily are both invasive in parts of the Midwest, and the orange daylily is definitely invasive throughout Illinois. And if you just want me to tell you a quick native alternative that I like to recommend for orange daylilies, it's orange butterfly milkweed, which attracts all kinds of butterflies and bees and, of course, is one of the sole host plants for the monarch butterfly, which only lays her eggs on milkweeds. So when I see these orange orange milkweeds around, I just long to advise the owners to please exchange them for some orange butterfly milkweed and get lots of lovely butterflies visiting for nectar and get the monarchs laying their eggs on them.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Around here where we live, those old orange daylilies, they are everywhere.
Everywhere.
They are everywhere. It would be nice to break things up a little bit.
But it's not just the orange ones, which already have become invasive. Where I live, unfortunately, the standard landscape model is non-native grasses from Japan, Korea, and China, and daylilies of various colors, lots of them yellow, from China. Hmm. And it's kind of heartbreaking because you see, and hosta, of course, it's also everywhere. So it's from China, too. So you see miles of Chinese flowers and grasses growing where I live, when there are so many native plants that grew here, which are just as beautiful and often identical, and also help the butterflies reproduce so we'll have them in the future.
Okay. Well, let's take, we have another caller here and about 5-6 minutes left. This is someone in Urbana. Let's talk with them on line one. Hello.
Hi. I saw an article in the New York Times about witch hazel blooming in the fall in a park and that it was a native, and we've got space for some. And I'm apparently like bloom in October and November, and I was wondering what use they are in terms of native insects. Do native insects like witch hazel?
Well, I'm not an expert on witch hazel. But I do know it also there are species that bloom in the late winter also. But I'm sure that if I were to look up witch hazel on the web, I would be able to find out which native insects are attracted to it and even perhaps lay their eggs on it. I mean, I think that there's probably no native species that doesn't have some useful function in our native ecosystem. And what it specifically is, you know, has to be looked into. But I would say witch hazels are a great choice for a native shrub.
Well, apparently the spring ones are actually oriental varieties. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, then I wouldn't want them.
Yeah,
no,
I was going to...
See, like so many things, there are native witch hazels. You don't have to get oriental witch hazels when there are native witch hazels, which are part of our native ecosystem.
Well, another problem is figuring out where to buy these things.
Oh.
And you know, one would prefer to patronize local nurseries, but you can't always be sure that they're going to have native.
Well, you have
plants.
To ask. You have to tell them you really want native species, and if you want a specific one, you really want that one. And I know around my area, they'll order them for somebody if they can. And you know, they grow, and so it may have to take some special effort to get them to the local nursery.
Okay.
There is that. I don't want to give names of specific nurseries, I guess, but. If you look at the Ladybird Wildflower Center, there is they have a section on their website which lists nurseries that sell native plants by state. And so one can look it up and find out if there's any conveniently located nurseries in Illinois to where you live, and you could, you know, you could go to them and they sell native plants and buy what they have to offer or will order for you.
And I will say that most of the garden centers are very, you know, if you ask, especially if a specific plant you're looking for, if you're asking, they'll generally do whatever they can to see if they can get it for you. And the more people ask, the more likely they are to maybe carry that in the future. So it always helps to talk to your local garden center. And then I would also say if you go to locally here in Central Illinois, if you go to Grand Prairie Friends to their website, they actually have listings of sources for native plants.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so you check that out and they can help you with that.
By the way, you made a misstatement. Not the guest did. When you were last talking about daylilies, you said people shouldn't grow the orange daylily. They should grow the native, not the orange, the orange milkweed. And I'm sure you just misspoke.
I meant to say, I'm not saying what people should do, but I would recommend that people who are interested in planting native plants and attracting butterflies and helping butterflies have reproductive areas would choose a native alternative to any daylily.
Oh, yeah.
Orange daylily,
they could choose
orange butterfly milkweed.
Yeah.
In a way you hadn't intended.
She was saying instead of those old orange daylilies.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Think about that. Hey,
thanks.
Well, thank you very much. You know, we got a couple of minutes here, and just because hosta came up a couple of minutes ago.
I know. I wondered if you were going to pick up on that.
You know, hosta, again, around here, it's everywhere. Now, mm-hmm. And it's a great hardy plant, and it comes in different sizes and shapes and stuff. But I particularly wanted to hear from Charlotte. Is there a good native alternative, do you think, to hosta?
Oh, yes. I'm just going to look it up in my book here real quickly. I hope I can find it so I can just list some of them. Okay, hosta. First of all, it's from China, and the narrow-leaf plantain lily, which is the one that I use as an illustration in the book at page 140, is, believe it or not, naturalized or invasive in parts of the Midwest. And it's hard to believe because these seem to be plants that just stay put, but they do have seeds. And so somehow this very tame-looking clump of green leaves that most people use just to fill space has actually become naturalized or invasive. And some of the native alternatives include what I have a drawing of here is seersucker sedge or plantain sedge, which is, of course, reminds you of plantain lily, which looks very much like hosta. And sadly, it's a plant that is somewhat endangered in parts of the Midwest, which is another good reason to plant it so that we help prevent it from becoming extinct. But I suggest native alternatives for people's clumps of hosta are native grasses like bottle brush grass, which is highly decorative and takes shade, and river oats, which is highly decorative and takes shade. Both of these are woodland grasses, so they would thrive in exactly the same place that hosta thrived, and all kinds of other grasses. And, of course, a lot of people have their hostas in full sun, and so one can plant all kinds of sun-loving alternatives like the milkweeds that we've been talking about so much, or alum root. And, I have just all kinds of them listed here. Ginger, Canadian wild ginger, is a fabulous native ground cover that is virtually indestructible and takes lots of shade and is beautiful all season long, or golden alexanders, or obedient plant even, or native stone crops. So, yes, there are lots of native alternatives to hosta.
Okay. Well, you know, we're about the point we're going to finish up here. I want to say again, if you're interested in doing some reading and research on native plants, you'd like to get more native plants into your garden, one book you might look at is this book we've been talking about here, The Midwestern Native Garden, An Illustrated Guide by Charlotte Edelman and Bernard Schwartz, and it is published by the Ohio University Press. So you can go out and take a look at that. And Sandy also has one here, too. This is a U of I publication.
Yeah, this actually is a U of I extension publication called Native Plants and the Home Landscape for the Upper Midwest. And I think the nice thing, this one's a little different avenue, because this one actually talks about how do I design with them. So it actually has even these templates where you can, okay, this is a garden for the shade, and these are the native plants that I can use. So it goes a little bit farther. It doesn't have quite all the information that Charlotte's book has, but I think the two make a great combination.
I think you should go out and get both.
I think you should too, because it really, and I'm not just kidding, David.
I think so.
And I've got to get your book now.
It's really good. You can go on, actually go to the University of Illinois website, and you can actually order the publication.
So thank you. I'm going to do
sure.
that immediately.
Well, Charlotte Edelman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And here in the studio with us, Sandy Mason, anything really quick going on that you want to mention in terms of programs? Nothing.
Not a darn thing. Herb Day, of course, is this Saturday.
Oh, okay.
You know, Chuck Voigt. I know you have Chuck Voigt on periodically.
Sure.
It's a Holiday Inn this Saturday, so I know people want to check that out. And even if they don't go to the program, they can actually check out the vendors there.
Okay.
So.
And then we'll see you again next month,
yes,
February.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Closer to spring.
So they say. Thank you very much.
Thank
Sandy
you.
Mason, she's horticulture educator with U of I Extension, Champaign County.